Welcome to Pitch Talks. Here is your host, Hannah Kaiser.
Hello. Is this on? This is on. Yeah. Happy Mike Trout's birthday to one and all. Welcome to Pitch Talks. Later we are going to have a live edition of Effectively Wild, but before that, we're going to talk to some other people who know a little bit about baseball. Bring some of them out right now. We're joined by Lindsay Adler and Tom Lay, also of Deadspin. By the way, I'm Hannah of Deadspin. I should have said that to start. This is Lindsay, who is often confused for me, but she's much better. And Tom, who edits both of us with unrelenting patience. You guys are here, right here. Come sit. Will one of you hand me my water? Thank you. All right. So since we are all at Deadspin, we talk about your... I, like, already know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Lindsay sits right next to me. Tom sits right across from me. But we're going to pretend that we didn't already plan this earlier today. Tom, tell me what has been your favorite baseball storyline this year.
Favorite baseball storyline this year?
Yeah, that's the question.
Probably the Colorado Rockies.
You sound biased.
Yeah, I am from Colorado, but I do think it's a genuinely interesting story that they're actually doing well and they finally found some pitchers who know how to pitch. I can't see anything.
Yeah, that's so that way you can't tell if people don't like you.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's good. We did that on purpose.
Yeah, I think obviously I've been following that, but the entire NL West is pretty crazy and fun. I mean, the Dodgers are
But is it crazy just because the Dodgers are so good, or is it actually interesting
It is an interesting division. I mean, the Diamondbacks are also good, the Rockies are good, and if the Dodgers weren't world historically good, it would actually be a really fun three-team race. Adler wrote something about what a fun three-team race it was, and then
now was quickly
no
proven wrong.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite old takes exposed. It's I just watched the division lead keep growing and growing and growing, and thinking back to that day when Tom was just why don't you write about this? And now it just sits there forever.
Yeah, that thing was accurate for I think it had 3 days where it was accurate, and then it was
and
wrong.
And the Dodgers just... So,
that was my fault, sorry.
Yeah, so Lindsay, tell us, what has been your favorite storyline to watch so far this year?
I have a number of weird and stupid ones. So I don't know that I necessarily have a favorite. I mean, watching the Dodgers just go bananas, of course, I think is a lot of people's favorites. But really enjoyed seeing what the Brewers have been doing. I kind of keep thinking, is this a scam? I mean, obviously the Cubs have the division for now, but I think the division lead is half a game and a half or something. They're holding on enough, and I think what's been really interesting is that they have guys like Eric Sogard going bananas, and I don't necessarily, I don't follow the Brewers, closely enough to know how they took, a handful of rando guys and made them actually really productive, but I think what's really interesting to me is that I can't kind of get over, the idea that in 2017 you can still mostly turn around a franchise by hiring a smart young nerd like David Stearns. I kind of would have assumed that market inefficiency would have closed up, and of course he was in Houston before, but I'm really interested to see what they do in the next couple of years, and I think it could be somewhat instructive depending on how things go.
Yeah, so Lindsay's working on a couple pieces about the Dodgers right now, and I'm going to ask Tom, as our sort of managing editor, with a season like this where one team is just continuing to set new records, but we're a national site and, we don't want to people get on our case about seeming biased about anything. People are mad now when we write positively about the Sixers because we once wrote negatively about the Sixers. So I'm curious, from an assigning standpoint, how you feel about this Dodgers season and what there is to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's always kind of tough. Well, not tough. It's liberating and tough at the same time, because at Deadspin we're not, our only policy is we want people to write about what they're interested in. And that usually manifests itself in good ways and in ways that are quirky and fun. But also can you know, like, you have to address the Dodgers at some point. And like,
right, like, Lindsay can't just keep writing about the Giants.
Right, exactly.
Well, they get worse than the Giants, and the Dodgers like, at all better. This year.
Like, our baseball content can't just be, like, White Sox posts and Giants posts. Like, so eventually you have to be like, you know, we need to address this. And so I think, but we're all capable of doing that, and I'm excited about the thing that Lindsay was working on today. But yeah, in general, that's like a sort of a, across all sports, like a deadspin sort of blessing and self-imposed curse. Like, we've gone through whole NBA seasons where we get to the end of the season, I'm like, how the hell did we not write about this guy? So we're trying to be better about that, I guess, but I think we're, I don't know, are we doing okay?
No.
Yeah, should be doing better.
I mean, I think the world wants to know what happened to Blight Sox, though.
Blight Sox has slowed down because our editor-in-chief, Tim Marchman, loves to talk about how busy he is, and he can't do it. And he started
too busy to take a sabbatical.
He started the post to prove to people that he wasn't too busy to do blog posts, and then he stopped doing it. So we still get the occasional one from other people. We need to start it back up.
Yeah. I think there are a couple different things that people ask me a lot about, like, you know, what's it like to work at Deadspin? It's great. It's fun. We got derailed for about an hour today talking about how large a portion of French fries should be. It's kind of what everyone thinks it is, but one of the pieces I'm working on about the Dodgers was something that Marchman had kind of assigned me last week. He was like, why don't you, you know, look at the differences between the 2017 Dodgers and the 98 Yankees and the 01 Mariners. And I was like, okay. So I, like, you know, pulled the roster makeup, and I, you know, was, there were some interesting things, and so I just kind of fleshed it out. I didn't really write with any brevity or focus, and so I, you know, sent him something today. I was like, well, this is kind of garbage, but here you go. And he was like, oh, cool. He's like, I like that you tried to, like, you know, compare it to the 98 Yankees and 01 Mariners. But I think, he's like, I think what the story really is, what you wrote about how they spread out their payroll. He was like, I think you should frame it that way. And I was just thinking, so you mean, like, totally scrapping what you told me to do? Okay, cool. Sounds good. Like, we're in agreement here.
Yeah, I mean, we have, like, a, we're, like, pretty nimble most of the time, which I think is good, but we all run into situations like that. But I do think it's good that we are, I don't know, we're collaborative, right?
Like, yeah,
we all bounce each other, ideas off each other. And yeah, I mean, like, we're not compelled to write about, like, any one thing. So we're not going to, like, put up something that we don't actually care about. If we publish something, it's because someone on staff actually wanted to write about it and thought it was interesting.
Right, like, I always think that it's a funny thing about Deadspin is people think that what distinguishes it is that they have no standards, but actually we have incredibly high standards. Like, we'll write a blog and then be like, never mind, let's just not publish this blog.
There, like, are a lot of really bad opinions held by various members of the Deadspin staff that don't ever see the light of day.
And there's no, I mean, my favorite thing about working there is the fact that there's no pressure to, like, justify time spent on something by necessarily publishing it. Like, you can frame a whole blog like that and then be like, well, we could put up this, but we'd rather, like, rework it now and make it better. But before we bring on our next guest or go to questions, I want to make sure that we ask Lindsay about her weekend in Cooperstown and if she met anyone who was there as a fan of Bud Selig.
So before I went up to Cooperstown, largely for fun, I was talking with Tom and Marchman, and I was like, what's something I could do that's not boring? And we just kind of talked about Selig a little bit, and I was like, why don't I try to find people who are there for Selig? So that's ostensibly what I tried to do.
You made a sign.
Yeah, I did. I was really lazy about it. I was like, okay, how can I identify a Bud Selig fan? It's like someone who is anti-labor, someone who is anti-fun, someone who really loves money. And I was like, okay, well, that is like probably 95% of the white dads here, so that's like, we gotta start elsewhere. And so the only thing I could do was really look for Brewers gear, which, I mean, I feel like there's a difference between Bud Selig fans who are fans because of, you know, what he did for baseball in Milwaukee, and there are people who are fans of Bud Selig as a commissioner, and I couldn't find any of the latter, basically because I didn't know how. But I talked to one couple on Saturday, and they were really nice. You know, they just said, we really appreciate that he brought baseball back to Milwaukee, and we appreciate that he did that, and we appreciate that he's a presence around Milwaukee, and when he was an owner, he would sign autographs for our kids and whatnot, and it was pleasant, and I totally understood it, but I spent most of the day with Expos fans, and so I couldn't really absorb too much of it. But the next day I was like, okay, I really want to actually try this, to actually find these people and maybe get some of my trip reimbursed. So I decided to make my boyfriend drive me to a Walmart in the middle of nowhere around midnight so I could find poster board and a Sharpie. And I went to Cooperstown on Sunday with a sign that said, if you are here to celebrate Bud Selig, please talk to me. Except I had to buy a foam board, and on one side it was white, and on the other side it was like navy blue, and I really like messed up the side on the white, and so I did better on the navy blue side, but you couldn't see it. Anyway, so I like...
Yeah, there was some, the celebrate word was like kind
yeah,
of fucked up.
Yeah, it was really there? Janky. Yeah. It was really bad. But I like went into it, and I was like, I'm not going to be one of those people who like crams the word at the end of the board. I did. So go and get breakfast, and like I put this sign down in this bakery, and people are like looking around for whoever the hell has this sign. Run into some of the people, some of the Expos fans I had met, and walking down to the field where they hold the induction ceremony, someone flagged me down, and they're like, Bud Selig. And I was like, all right. Like
I answer to that now.
Yeah.
I am Bud Selig.
The sign is working. And so I went and I talked to this man, and he was very nice. He was so baseball dad. Like, Brewers hat, Brewers shirt, like, socks pulled up to here.
Was
and
the
like,
shirt tucked into his pants, even though it wasn't a long-sleeve button-down?
Yeah. And, okay, but I did see a lot of jerseys tucked into shorts.
Yeah, that's the yeah. cool thing.
Not Brewers fans, just random men.
Tucked into cargo shorts, maybe?
Yes. And so I talked to this guy for a while, and it was interesting, and he was talking about how he's a real estate attorney, and he had done some work for the Brewers in Major League Baseball, and I was like, okay, whatever. So I, you know, take this recording. I think I talked to him for about 10 minutes, and then I go to the ceremony, and I kind of just post up in the back with my poster, and I talked to another couple from Wisconsin, and they were really nice, and I think the husband actually kind of understood it. Like, he wasn't saying the same things about how the guy who had flagged me down was saying things like, he was like, well, you know, it had gotten to a point where the players were making too much money, so it wasn't Bud Selig's fault. They, you know, that there was, he called it a lockout, and I was like, that is extremely revealing. But this other guy who I talked to actually in the field was nice. But mostly I just sat there and people stared at me, and Astros fans would come up and say things like, you know why we're in the American League? And I'm like, yep, you know. That's why I have the sign. Or Expos fans would look at me suspiciously. I'm like, no, we're on the same team. Like, we are on the same team here. Like, I didn't want to become a spectacle, but how the hell else was I going to find Bud Selig fans? At the end of the day, it just became very amusing to be like, yes, I low-key posted up in Cooperstown looking for Bud Selig fans, and I found, like, six people in 2 days, and they were all couples. Anyway, so I go home, and I'm, like, you know, writing this story, and I'm like, wow, this is so fun. And I Google the guy who had told me that the players were making too much money. Turns out he had done a lot of legal work for the Brewers and Major League Baseball, including helping facilitate moving the Expos out of Montreal. And I was like, I don't know what to do.
Do you still have his number?
No, I didn't. And I mean, it's not my fault. Like, I wasn't going to Google the guy while I was talking to him, but I was like, damn. If I had known, I would have asked a lot of different questions, and now I just have to write that as a sentence in this piece. So that was my time in Cooperstown.
Did you get the trip expense?
Got a little bit of an expense. Oh, and the sign is now still folded up in the trunk of our car.
Yeah, we can put it in the office.
I didn't know where to dispose of it.
If you guys have questions for Tom and Lindsay, hold on to them real quick. We're going to bring out a few more people, and then we're going to do questions for everybody at the end, because we're kind of cutting into time. Tom and Lindsay, you guys are going to move down to the other couch. And we are going to bring out Anthony DiComo, MLB.com's Mets beats writer, to ask him what went wrong this season. Anthony, if you can hear me. This way. Your couch for right now.
It's lonely, all by myself.
For now, it's just you. Also, feel free to jump in, Tom and Lindsay, if you'd like to challenge him on anything, but he probably knows more about the Mets than any of us do.
Probably not, actually.
So we were talking about this a little bit backstage, and you said it was fine if I asked you, are they going to fire Terry Collins?
Define fire, right?
Because Terry Collins long for this city?
Probably not. You know, obviously it hasn't been I don't know if you guys have noticed, but it hasn't been a great season for the Mets. And it's a convenient time for Terry's time to end. He's been here a while, obviously. His contract is up. He's almost 70 years old, and he has said that he does not want to manage into his 70s. So, like, it's the perfect time. You know, you're dating. You don't know if you want to make it really serious. Like, let's just back out right now. The problem is, or the question is, you know, does this happen the clean way or the messy way? We were talking backstage with Jay Jaffe about this, and it's like they could, you know, offer him a job somewhere in the organization in player development, which he's actually really, really good at, make it a nice soft landing, or they could make it public and messy and not fun for anyone and just splashed across all the tabloids. And I honestly don't know which it's going to be, but I do think
do you know what it should be? So I'm curious. The obviously part of what happened this season is they were supernaturally cursed with one injury after another,
sure.
Which you would think is just bad luck, but it's gotten to the point where it seems like somebody in the organization is mismanaging maybe health information or I don't know what, and is that person Terry Collins? Is there someone to blame? Like, can you actually put someone at fault for all the injuries, or is that just terrible, terrible luck?
Well, luck is a part of it. It's certainly not the whole thing. And the problem when you start talking about this and everyone wants to fire the whole training staff every year, everyone wants to fire the medical staff every year, and I think the point is there's so many people along this chain that you can't really blame just one person. And you can't absolve any one person of blame either. Sure, Terry Collins has played a role, and his role in this chain is communication between the players and the training staff and everyone else. But he's far from the only one who this is an issue with. Ray Ramirez is far from the only one. It's everyone along the line, and the Mets have said time and again, it's not like, I get all these questions on Twitter, like, why don't you ever ask about the training staff? Why don't you? We have asked so many times, and they have claimed so many times that they've looked at this, and they've implemented changes, both specific to players, like Yoenis Cespedes, and just team-wide, organization-wide, and they have.
Those changes for Cespedes weren't that he should stop smoking?
If we drink more water.
Okay. Yes. Close. They were like, when you're putting something in your mouth, maybe it could be a cup of water.
Yes, instead of a cigarette, yes. theoretically. But no, I actually haven't heard that was a suggestion.
That would be a good... That if he's listening, if you're out there... So.
If you're out there, put down the cigarettes.
Not as young as you once were.
Right. But the point is that there are so many things along this, and is what they're doing enough? Maybe, probably not. Is firing Terry Collins going to make the difference and all of a sudden everyone's healthy? Absolutely not. So it's not just this cure-all that's going to fix everything. And certainly if they had a different manager this year, it's not like they would be in first place right now.
Right. So I think the most interesting thing, to me at least, about this Mets season is that they were a team that came into 2017 explicitly being like, we're going to try the same thing we tried in 2016 because we were pretty happy with the getting to the postseason results. And we're just hopefully going to do better once we hit October. They literally made, like, what, no off-season moves?
Basically nothing.
At all. They're like, we're going to do the exact same thing and hope for the same result, a little bit different at the end. And they got a completely different result. And so I'm curious, heading into 2018, not that we should totally give up on this season now, I guess.
No, we can give up on it.
What moves are they going to look to make to contend? I mean, are they going to hope that they get 2016 Mets, or are they going to be like, we need to change 2017 Mets?
Well, it's a different situation this time around. Going into last offseason, you know, they didn't have to do anything. They probably should have, in hindsight, in retrospect, but everyone was coming back. All the pitchers were coming back. The only hitter who wasn't coming back was Yoenis Cespedes, who they re-signed to make it ultimately the same exact team. It didn't work, but this year that's not the case. They have got a million free agents. A couple of them they've already traded away. A couple of them are going to leave. A couple of them they might look to re-sign. But ultimately, especially on the offensive side, they have to go out and make moves. They don't have a choice. They have a ton of money coming off the books. They're going to be active in free agency. So there will be changes. Now, that doesn't ultimately mean that they're going to go out and be a totally different team, because it could be we're going to re-sign Jay Bruce and we're going to keep second base with all the kind of mishmash of guys that we have now, and we're going to hope that David Wright gives us something at third base, and we have Wilmer Flores and all these other people who can play there, and you know, Travis d'Arnaud is okay at catcher, and we've got our starting pitching, so we can't go out and invest in a big arm. So ultimately, it could look very much similar. But they do have to actually go out and make some of those moves. And maybe Jay Bruce signs elsewhere. Maybe some team offers him, you know, $80 million and he goes somewhere else. And then they have to make a move elsewhere. But, they are going to be forced into action this winter, kind of to an extent that we haven't really seen under Sandy Alderson. So it will be interesting to see the direction that they go, because we don't see them splurge during the winter very often. And doing so this past winter, whether it had been on a, you know, one of those top flight closers who was available, or even just someone who can give the bench some depth, might have made a bit of a difference.
Yeah, I'm curious, but the potential moves that they will either be forced to make or not in the offseason, how committed do you feel like they are to bringing Harvey back for his last season? Or do you feel like they're going to try to flip him in this offseason now that they maybe know that he's not going to always deliver on the potential?
Yeah, no, they're committed to bringing him back. I don't think they want to be. Necessarily. Matt Harvey has not been a model citizen. He certainly has not been a great pitcher for them this year. But they're not just going to trade him right now at the low point of his value. That's just bad business. Really, all they can do is bring him back and hope that he's healthy and hope that in his walk year he goes out and is something resembling the Matt Harvey of old. And maybe that is dead and gone forever. But if you trade him now, you don't get anything. For a guy who's a year from free agency, who has not had a good year at all, who you don't know if he'll ever really be healthy again, you get nothing at all for him. But if you keep him, maybe you get a guy who gives you 150 decent innings next year, and that's way more valuable than anything you'd get in return. So to answer your question, as much as I think the Mets would like to blast Matt Harvey in a rocket ship to the moon, they don't really have a choice but to keep him around right now.
Lindsay has a question.
Can I ask a question?
You can ask a question.
I think a lot about David Wright and his continued attempts to come back. One, why does he keep doing this? It's just making me depressed. And two, how do those attempts, you know, change the equation for what the Mets have to do? Because from my perspective, they probably have to keep honoring his attempts.
Yeah. Well, I was actually talking about this with David at some point. He was like, well, how does Lindsay feel about me continuing to try to come back?
Honestly?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I get that exact question a lot. It's like, why is he continuing to do this? Why is he continuing to do this? Because he feels like he can and he wants to. And you kind of have to put yourself in David Wright's shoes. This is a competitive athlete. It's really hard in that situation to kind of take the step back and see it from the perspective that we all do, which is that, like, maybe he's cooked, maybe he's totally done. These guys who are elite-level athletes always feel like they have something left in the tank. And maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But to your second question, like, how do they move forward with this in mind? They kind of have to operate this winter, and they started doing it last winter for the first time. They didn't go really full bore in this direction, but they started. You kind of have to look at it like he's not even on your roster, and everything you get from here on out is a bonus. So I would... If I'm the Mets front office, I look at acquiring a full-time third baseman, whether that's Mike Moustakas or someone else, on the market this winter. And, you know, maybe you get that guy, maybe you don't. But you cannot assume or even hope at this point that David Wright plays a single game for you. And, you know, I think a lot of people around the Mets really want him back. I think a lot of Mets are depressed, like Lindsay is, about his situation. But the fact of the matter is this is a business... And you have to move forward just assuming that you're not getting anything from him.
Is he still traveling with the team? Is he still
is
around?
Is he happy? We want to know that. Is he okay?
He's a multimillionaire with a model for a wife and a beautiful young daughter. I think he's okay.
He's gonna and be
I
all think right. he's gonna be, don't cry for Dan. Right?
I think, you know, given the perspective of, you know, once 10 years from now when he's retired and he's out of baseball or whatever he's doing, I think he'll be able to see that. But right now, yeah, I think he goes through days probably where he's a little depressed about his situation, because again, these are guys who feel like they're capable of doing one thing and they don't ultimately do it, or they can't ultimately do it. It is tough. It's like the one thing that you've been trained to do from the time you were 5 years old, you, all of a sudden you can't do it. It's a difficult situation. It is a sad situation for him and for a lot of Mets fans who have followed him for basically all of their lives. So certainly everyone's rooting for him, but it's tough to count on him at this point.
Any more questions from Tom or Lindsay?
What's the most salacious Matt Harvey party rumor you've ever heard?
Can
we print it at Deadspin?
Yeah, there's a bodega right across the street, and you can go and pick up a copy of the New York Post. Page 6 will have everything you want, I promise.
Do you know who is behind the dildo in the locker?
Okay, Hannah, give context.
Could you be more specific?
There was a dildo in the locker. I'm gonna blank on who it was behind.
It was in Kevin Plawecki's locker. It was behind TJ Rivera.
See, he knew what I was talking about. Don't play coy with me, Tacoma.
I have some... actually, a funny story was apparently me and a couple of other beat writers, I think Steve Gelbs was one, actually broke the news to Kevin Plawecki that this was in his locker. Because we had already left the park when these pictures started circulating, and all of a sudden you see it, and I texted Kevin Plawecki, and I was like, hey, what's going on, man? And he's like, wait, what? And you can imagine what kind of ensued from there. He wasn't thrilled about it, but...
So it wasn't his dildo?
It was not. He actually had a press conference.
So one suspect down.
He actually had a press conference the next day. Not a press conference, but there were about 20 reporters around his locker the next day to ask him about that. And yes, he confirmed that it was not, in fact, his.
All right, well, that's... All right, well, if you find out whose it is, tips... At Deadspin, deadspin.com.
I think we found out who it was, but we couldn't say for some reason.
I found out who it was, but
you
I can't
found
say.
Out who
yeah,
it was,
that's
yeah.
my scoop, but I thought he was going to confirm it for me.
Why don't you say it right now?
We'll talk later. We'll talk later.
Okay. Backstage.
I thought that I was going to find out if I was right. I'm not going to say it in slander.
Okay,
I actually don't know for sure. I have a couple of suspects on my shortlist, but.
Before we wrap up this segment, because I assume we have some Mets fans with us in attendance, is there hope for the rest of the season? Is there a reason to tune in for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I'm at Rosario.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the reason, and Dominic Smith, and eventually Harvey will theoretically come back and throw a couple of starts, and Noah Syndergaard will throw a couple of starts. So, like, there's going to be things that are happening. Is there hope that they make some miraculous run? No, of course not. They're not making the playoffs. But, you know, I've said this. I've covered this team since 2010 now. And even those years where they were in fourth place every single year, they make news. They do things, and whether it's a dildo in someone's locker or whatever it might be, they make news and they're entertaining, and I guarantee you, like, those things are going to happen over the final 2 months. So they'll be interesting for sure.
All right, before we bring out Jay Jaffe, because I totally fucked up the timing of this, we are going to do some questions for these three. If you have questions for Anthony, for Tom, or for Lindsay, raise your hands. We can't really see you, but I'll I see somebody.
Sorry. To what degree would you blame Jeff Wilpon for all the dysfunction in the Mets organization? I feel like he's always mentioned as a culprit, as a meddler, as a coach's son, piece of shit, and I hate him, and I want to shit on him right now. Can you please?
Oh.
Is that a question or a statement?
He doesn't like Wilpon, if you missed.
To what degree is Jeff Wilpon a meddler?
Look, in every sports organization, whether it's baseball or football, basketball, whatever, everything starts with ownership. Ownership sets the tone for the organization. And some owners are more involved than others. Some owners are more aloof than others. The Wilpons are certainly more involved than most. So you cannot absolve them of blame, certainly. The fact that things have not gone the Mets' way, it always starts with ownership. Does that mean that Sandy Alderson has done his job perfectly? Does that mean that Terry Collins has done his job perfectly? No, of course not. kind of similar to the injury question, there is blame to go around. But when you're spreading it around, yeah, Jeff deserves some of the blame for sure. And I would say that about, I know this is a political answer, but I would say that about any owner of any team where things have not gone wrong, or excuse me, where things have not gone right for a lengthy period of time, you have to look at ownership. Yeah, he's involved in the day-to-day operations of the team. That's not particularly unusual. Some owners are not at all. Some owners are, you know what, let the baseball staff do their jobs, let the marketing staff and the business staff do their jobs, and they don't do anything. Jeff is not like that. He's certainly not the only owner who's not like that. You could probably name a dozen owners who are like that. So, yes, he is definitely involved, but I wouldn't call that unique.
Okay, if you have a question, wait for us to bring you a mic, but also raise your hand. Right up here in the front, we got two. You guys can hand the mic to each other. I mean, first, just ask a question. Yeah, don't just pass it back and forth. Don't play hot potato with the mic, but like when you're done.
So something that I feel like I almost never see written about with respect to the Mets is that their defense is actually historically bad, and like
it's really bad.
It's quite a bit worse even than like the next worst team in Major League Baseball. And there's all this talk about repairing the pitching staff and the bullpen. And there's never any talk about the way it starts with, especially the defense up the middle, which will obviously be repaired a bit by Omed Rosario. But are you hearing anything about repairing the defense?
Well, I'll clarify that notion a little bit because their defense is very, very bad. Most of it has been in three spots, third base, shortstop, and second base. If you look at their outfield, Jay Bruce is actually having an above average season. Michael Conforto is having a pretty good season. Jonas Cespedes, when he wants to, can have a good season. You know, Lucas Duda, when he was here, was fine at first base, but second base, shortstop, and third base have been really big problem issues for them. Omed Rosario obviously takes a big weakness and turns it into a strength for them, so that's going to solve a lot of the issue right there. We don't know what they're going to do at third base, but presumably what they do will be better than this kind of mishmash of Jose Reyes and Asdrubal Cabrera and what they've been putting out there this season. So theoretically, it won't take all that much for the defense to become better. But you're right, it is a problem. And that's, I would say, one of the things that Sandy Alderson has struggled to do the most since he's been here, is he has looked for offensive players, he has looked for power, and he has sacrificed defense in doing it. And it's been a strategy of theirs. They thought they could get away with it. I guess they had a pitching staff that strikes out a lot of guys and doesn't allow a lot of balls in play. Well, they don't really have that anymore. Their pitching staff has been below average this year, and it's kind of exposed the defense even more. Like I said, I don't think it'll take a ton to make that a pretty dramatic improvement.
And your buddy, go ahead.
I have two, but they should be pretty quick. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. Tom, you said there's some bad opinions at Deadspin. What's the worst one?
Oh, man. Can we each get a vote on what the worst one is?
Like, of all opinions or just baseball opinions?
We can start with baseball.
Adler doesn't like Aaron Judge. I don't even know what your take is at this point. Just that he's not cool or something?
No.
It's the teeth, isn't it?
No. I just, it was a lot of hype really fast.
Yeah.
I just, in the home run derby, I prefer Giancarlo. It was just, his home run style is just more for me. Judge can be great and do his thing, and it's great to see Judge be great, but I'm not going to invest all of my hype into Judge.
Who do you think has the worst baseball opinion, Lindsay?
Wait, non-baseball opinion?
No, we're going to do baseball opinions first.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
Hannah doesn't like Bryce Harper.
What? What is the...
I regret having my coworker.
Why does the whole Deadspin staff just hate great baseball players?
I told love you that in confidence.
Not enough people think it's tragic for Lindsay and I that the Giants are having a terrible season.
Yeah, whatever.
Not enough. All right, fine. Non-baseball division, Tom. What's the worst take?
Well, a lot. the non-baseball division, many of the bad opinions have been made public, unfortunately. Well, we had one today, which was Sammer, our news editor, thinks that when you go to a restaurant to you order like a burger or a sandwich that comes with fries, you should be able to order a sprinkling of fries, which is just 5 to 7 fries.
He wants fewer fries.
The full thing of like fries is too much to eat.
Okay,
and he's
but...
like, this is wasteful. And we were like, no, you want restaurants to serve people 5 to 7 fries. And he was like, yeah, I'd pay like $1 for that.
Like wrapped in like a little, like a sprig of thyme or something.
But here's the issue. After about 45 minutes of us arguing about this, he revealed that his girlfriend, who was a close friend of mine, doesn't finish her fries, and so she tries to have him eat them, and apparently that drives him...
This is just a personal problem.
Yeah, it insults him so deeply that he wants to deprive the rest of us from fries, and I just want to say that I'm a very good friend to Sammer because I did not tell Heather that Sammer was being a dumbass about her eating preferences.
I don't think I've ever seen Drew so angry in our Slack. He called Sammer an imbecile.
Oh, that's not true.
Like every take Marchman has gets through that angry.
Yeah, I mean, Marchman has like a whole notebook full of bad, awful takes.
Like, the worst take overall is that there are a lot of people on staff who like soccer.
That's not a bad thing. You're being rude, Dan.
I'm into that last one. I agree. Soccer's terrible. And my second question, yes, that was good. I like that one. Second question, hey, DeComo, when are we going to see Tebow?
Man, I wish I'd thought to ask that.
I think not September.
He's going to be up before Rosario.
Yeah, that's the joke, of course. Look, like, the funny thing about Tim Tebow is that he's actually been playing really well. And, like, there's a non-zero chance that he'll get to double A at some point on merit, which is bizarre that I'm saying this out loud, but it could happen. You know, it would be... Look, they could put him on the 40-man roster and bring him up in September and make it a circus and make it a total shit show. But everyone knows what that is, and it's so fake. And I really can't see them doing it for that reason, despite the fact that I personally would kind of enjoy that. Like, it would be fun.
We would definitely enjoy that.
Yeah, they're going to do it.
I think a lot of people...
Let's put bets on it right now.
Well, and here's the other thing. St. Lucie, the single A affiliate where he is right now, just set a full season attendance record. It's August. Columbia was selling out games left and right where he started the season, and they've had more people than they've ever had before. So, like, it's real, and all these people who want to hate on him, like, people come out and see this guy. So you could almost understand why they would want to bring him up, but it's so hard to justify from a baseball perspective that he might have to actually hit his way up, and he might actually do it, which is so weird. But maybe.
Okay, we're going to take more questions at the end, because right now we need to talk to a man who just earlier today, Dan Shaughnessy, called an analytics geek intent on sucking the joy out of baseball. It is Jay Jaffe! Wait, come on, let's screw down. Jay has a new book out right now, the Cooperstown Casebook, Who's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, Who Should Be In, and Who Should Pack Their Plaques. Before you wrote this book, you were mostly known for JAWS, which is a system that objectively measures a candidate's Hall of Fame worthiness by comparing him to the players at his position who are already enshrined, and it breaks it down to just like one single number that you can look at, and then you wrote 400 plus pages. Why?
There's no money in spreadsheets. No, look, if all I wanted to do was to give like a single metric that was basically like a binary system of who should be in, who should be out. I mean, you can take JAWS to be that, but that was never my intention. And to me, you know, I think the importance is it's a tool that I invented, uses wins above replacement to measure each player, offense, defense, base running, everything we can at least try to estimate. you know, to try to get a handle on where these guys fit in historically, but you still have to bring context to it. And to me, it's much more important, or it's much more interesting, to be armed with that, with those numbers, and bring context to them and tell these stories with that as background, rather than to just say, you know, 67 Jaws, you're in, 65 Jaws, nah, screw it. You know, so I wanted to tell those stories, and having written about the Hall of Fame now for 15 election cycles, I have enough research under my belt that's not necessarily as attached to the numbers that I wanted to put in one place.
Yeah, I'm curious, when you are personally considering someone and their worthiness, what are the non-Jaws things that you look at and give weight to? Is it like career longevity, postseason performance, awards? What are things that people would be like, ah, he doesn't just care about the bandstand?
Yeah, it's, you know, I do look at postseason performance. When you look back at the players who were in the Hall of Fame, the ones who don't measure up statistically are often guys who had, you know, maybe a couple of great postseasons to their name, especially in the first half of the century when you didn't have television and when you didn't have, advanced statistics or even, like, wide dissemination of even the most basic statistics. Fame came from the World Series, and fame is what got you into the Hall of Fame.
But, like, now that we do have these advanced statistics, is there something someone could do today? Like, is there still those benchmark counting stats that would impress you?
Well, I think the benchmarks are there, but some benchmarks have become extremely attainable and others unattainable. You know, 500 home runs was something that, only 14 or 15 guys had up through the mid-90s, and then suddenly we got a flood of them. Now, 15 of the 27 guys who have 500 home runs are in the Hall of Fame. Some of the others aren't yet eligible. Some of them are under suspicion based on connections to performance-enhancing drugs. 300 wins used to be a lot easier. We may never see another 300-game winner. Or, you know, if we don't, or if we do, it's going to be, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. So rather than get attached to these round-numbered milestones, I think it's important to recognize that baseball history is an uneven playing field. There's some eras where it's easier to do those things than others. And, to use the advanced statistics to try to see where the real value is and what these players actually contributed value-wise rather than getting attached to 3,000 hits or whatever. I mean, like, I think about Craig Biggio, a great ball player who's certainly worthy of the Hall of Fame, but the year that he got his 3,000th hit, he was one of the worst players in the last 25 years, if not more. He was like 2 wins below replacement level. I mean, he was such a detriment to his team that he actively prevented them from winning. He was worse than a minor league scrub they would have called up. And that's a shame because, I mean, Craig Biggio deserved better than that. Everybody deserves better than that if they've put in that kind of time and made that kind of contribution. But it's a shame that, like, chasing the milestone became more important than winning baseball in that context. And I think by recognizing these things, we can understand, you know, that guys, not everybody who fell short of a milestone, you know, is unworthy of the Hall of Fame.
Right. Like, would he have been unworthy if he hadn't gotten that 3,000?
Right. No, he wouldn't have been any less worthy of the Hall of Fame had he finished at 2,900. I mean, there's a couple examples that I write about in the book of guys, you know, back before there was baseballreference.com or even like a reliable baseball encyclopedia, there were guys who stopped playing when they had like 2,900 and some odd hits, and they didn't realize that 3,000 hits was going to be a big deal. Sam Crawford and Al Simmons are two that come to mind. They just when they saw retrospectively that it was a big deal, they kind of kicked themselves and like. You know, one of them, Al Simmons said, like, if I think about all the times that I asked out of ball games because I was basically hungover, I want to slit my throat.
Right, that could have been the difference. So you talk about how you've been writing about the Hall of Fame for 15 years. Was there something that made you obsessed with it? Like, was there a particular slight or a particular person you were like, that guy doesn't deserve to get in, I need to show people why?
There were two things, there are two major findings that really go all the way back to the beginning of Jaws, when it wasn't even called Jaws, when I started this at 2004 in Baseball Prospectus, that really kind of formed the backbone of this book. One was looking at the 2004 ballot and that was that Burt Blyleven, with 287 wins, but something like 260 or 270 losses, was far more worthy of the Hall of Fame than Jack Morris, with 254 wins and a much higher winning percentage, and a game that a lot of us who were growing up in that era remember fondly, with the 10-inning shutout in 1991, seventh game of the World Series. The fact that so many players on the Veterans Committee, particularly ones who were voted in during the tenure of Frankie Frisch in the late 60s and early 70s, and then his colleague Bill Terry in the 70s to about 76, are some of the worst Hall of Famers in there statistically. Those two findings are things that I really kind of seized upon when I was at Baseball Prospectus, and really, you know, drove my fascination with the institution and the mechanism of how people got in and why they didn't get in. And, you know, I tell the story of Blyleven and Morris. It's the story of how advanced statistics got into the Hall of Fame conversation, these all-encompassing value metrics, and just the rancor that accompanied that, which even today, literally today, is still spilling out. In the form of
Dan Shaughnessy,
reverse touting my book. It's amazing to me. That's amazing to me, and the extent to which this cronyism and this like crappy class of players who, by and large, excelled in the 1920s when offense was at a high. Not unlike the late 90s and 2000s, but you know, in a way that just I don't think people, certainly the players didn't appreciate at the time, didn't understand at the time, and a lot of historians didn't appreciate at the time. But now we have better perspective on that. We don't use those guys as model Hall of Famers. So, you know, my goal throughout this is to identify the players that are actually worthy, and that's really what's driven this for 14, 15 years.
Yeah, and looking over, I mean, you take such an exhaustive look at people who are in the Hall of Fame. I'm curious if you came across any trends beyond being good at baseball. Are there teams that are historically overlooked, teams that are historically given too much credit? Is there an East Coast bias, like people accuse baseball media of having, reflected in the Hall of Fame? Or I know you write about positions that have been overlooked.
Yeah, I would say historically overlooked, the Montreal Expos always get the shit end of the stick when it comes to the Hall of Fame. I mean, even Gary Carter, who's number two in Jaws at catcher, and was just the most fucking obvious Hall of Famer that like one could see in terms of like, you know, the honors that he had, the All-Star appearances, the fact that, you know, he won a World Series with the Mets, and was legitimately, you know, the best player in the league at his position for the better part of a decade. It took him 6 years to get in. What the? I don't understand that. And it was, and I think a lot of it's because, you know, he spent part of his career with the Expos. Andre Dawson, not a great Hall of Famer by my system, but certainly somebody who stuck around long enough and put up some good numbers and was worthy of the honor. Tim Raines, who just got elected this past year. Larry Walker, who's stuck down on the ballot in the 20% range and really, you know, should be far more recognized. Those guys have really gotten like a rough ride from the voters. And on the other end of it, obviously it's the Yankees, I think. You look at those Yankees teams of the 20s and 30s, the Ruth Gehrig Yankees and slipping into the DiMaggio Yankees, and there are a lot of guys in the Hall of Fame from those teams that are like maybe the sixth or seventh best guy, you know, the third best pitcher on the staff. And really, you know, these are like, they're guys like Red Ruffing and Wade Hoyt who, you know, they basically had the high win totals that were driven by getting Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, you know, putting up big numbers, you know, and just hanging in there and getting those wins. Or Earl Combs, the center fielder, who played like 12 or 13 years and was literally the nicest guy. I mean, go back to your room after the game and drink a glass of milk and go to bed. Nice guy. You know, never get in any trouble while Babe Ruth is like streaking down the train car, you know, getting in. And it's like, there's an inequity there that's kind of frustrating. And, you know, I think before I came on the scene, and the book that really kind of spurred my interest in this was Bill James's Politics of Glory. That was written in the mid-90s, and at the time, the Phil Rizzuto battle was like probably to that point the biggest Hall of Fame battle ever, and I'm glad I missed that.
Are you?
Yeah, I kind of am. I kind of am. Look, I understand.
You have enough battles?
Yeah, there's enough battles. I mean, like, the Blylevin and Morris was exhausting enough, and we're going to go through that again with Omar Vizquel this winter, and probably Yadi Molina a few years down the road, those are not particularly the most fun things, because you have to dig in your heels and to say that this guy doesn't belong is far less fun than advocating for somebody who does belong and seeing that actually come to fruition, like we did with Blylevin, like we did with Tim Raines this past year. Being up in Cooperstown and seeing Tim Raines actually inducted and getting to meet Tim Raines and take a photo with him, I mean, that was quite a thrill. So, you know, I don't want to be the guy to tell you that Phil Rizzuto sucked. I mean, he didn't suck. He just wasn't really a strong model for a Hall of Famer.
So I'm curious, if you had the power to revamp the way the voting is done, do you think that that's part of the problem? Like, would you want to revamp Hall of Fame voting? I know they've done it a bunch of times. You detail all the various levels.
I certainly think it could stand revamping. I think that if you were going to look at it, at how to revamp it, you could, you know, instead of just the writers getting the vote, you could consider broadcasters in there. I think that they certainly these days see enough games that they have opinions that are worth considering. Now, the problem becomes, though, that many broadcasters are actually employed by the teams, so you have some concerns about bias there and pressure from employers. You know, I also think that there are probably more historians that should be involved in this. You know, for the most part, you know, I mean, basically, it's limited. The pool is limited to BBWA writers who have 10 consecutive years of experience with affiliated publications. And you know, if that gets disrupted, which you know these days in this industry is certainly possible, you know, you can get derailed from that. MLB.com writers, I think, you know, they are who just last year, 2 years ago. A year and a half ago, were added to the BBWAA, you know, are just as worthy of getting the franchise as anybody else. I know that a lot of those guys have put in, you know, years and years and years. Where are you in this?
Thank you.
How many years do you have?
I would actually be, if we were in the BBWAA from the time I started, I would be eligible for my first vote this winter. Instead, it's going to be another 8 years.
Yeah. So they didn't grandfather those guys in. I myself, you know, have to wait until 2021 if I survive in this industry long enough. And believe me, I think about that every day.
Bleak, and then a little less bleak. Still bleak. Well, but I thought you were going to end on a bleaker note.
No.
With a young daughter, my man.
Surviving in this industry is obviously we see the layoffs. We know what's happening. But getting back to revamping the electorate, especially with regards to the veterans committees. The small committees, they're usually 16, at most have one or two trained historians on them. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, it's got 8 Hall of Famers there who are, you know, largely either willing to vote in their friends or want to decide that, no, my country club isn't good enough for you. You know, you're not good enough for my country club. I'd like to get it away from that, but, you know, ultimately it's the Hall of Fame's decision, and having been on a committee that pitched a proposal to them to expand the ballot from 10 slots to 12. I don't see any of these changes that I've advocated coming true anytime soon.
On that note, I think we're going to open it up to questions again. Before we do, I would like to give my lovely husband a shout out because it's his birthday. If you see a man with a beard who looks like he might be in his late 20s, there's like a 5% chance it's him, so you might as well wish him a happy birthday. Raise your hand if you're married to me and you're turning 28 today. Thank you, Lindsay. Any questions for any of our wonderful guests? Jay, because he didn't get to answer questions before, but any of these other guys too. Oh, we got a bunch. We got a bunch up front. So we're going to like bring up the mic and then we'll pass it around here.
Okay. I have one for Anthony and one for Jay. Anthony, what is it like covering MLB and being employed by MLB?
Yeah, we could spend the next 2 hours on that question. The short answer is, you know, one of the things that I've really been thankful for that MLB.com has done is that I've never really altered my coverage based on, you know, what I would be afraid or what anyone would be afraid that the reaction from the team would be. Now, obviously, my stuff goes on Mets.com. It goes on the team's official website. And there are certainly editorial layers at our shop that might be different from if you worked at the Daily News or the Post. But from my perspective, from my tunnel vision, what I do, I report the same way my colleagues do at all the newspapers. And that's something that's been really great for us.
And Jay, of current MLB players under 30, who do you think are the most likely Hall of Famers?
Trout. I would say Giancarlo Stanton's probably on the path. Kershaw, who's actually 30.
I think Tebow just turned 30, so.
Yeah.
Just missed the cutoff.
Oh, somebody! I had a good tweet this weekend. Somebody asked.
Congratulations!
Yes. So, I really did. I'm proud of this, but I really did want to bring up my Tim Tebow tweet. And somebody asked. You know what was like? I think it was Jesse Spector said, like, you know, your wildest sports prediction for 25 years from now. Mine was 78-year-old Barry Bonds comes out of retirement to reclaim the home run crown from Tim Tebow. I thought I was pretty proud of that. I don't know. I thought that showed some good creativity. Getting back to the question. I mean, I think Bryce Harper probably, but he's got a lot of health issues that he has to contend with. Beyond those guys, I don't see.
Would you like to speculate wildly on Aaron Judge while he's in his?
No. I did something on Barry Bonds today and the home run record, which we're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of, and. The only, besides Trout and Harper, who have to put up, like, you know, 14 and 15, 40 home run seasons, like, respectively, to get into the picture, the only major league player currently active that you can look at and think, okay, this guy might have a chance, is Cody Bellinger, who's got 32 home runs in 90 games. Now, that is the, like, we're reducing it to absurdity here, but you've got a 21-year-old who's probably going to set a home run record for the for National League rookies, if not all rookies. And you know, in general, you look at guys who are that young who get off to career starts like that, and you know, the best guess is that's probably a guy who at least has a shot at the Hall of Fame. So those are my answers, and it's pretty small, but there are going to be more than that.
I think we have someone right here with a mic.
So, Jay, apologies if the book, I have to wait for the Queen's Library to get it to me, so it's going to be a while. I was wondering if you found any player or players you think Jaws, with greater context, misrepresents either for good or for ill.
You know, the one that's been talked about a lot on the internet today is Sandy Koufax, who ranks 87th in Jaws. He's well below the marks for the average pitcher in the Hall of Fame on both career and peak because he only pitched for 12 years. What's missing there, obviously, is the postseason context. He had a 0.95 ERA in the postseason. He's probably, if you gave me a choice of one pitcher, one game, you know, for the future of the planet, I would probably choose him. But because he only really had about five big seasons, and what he did, putting up these microscopic numbers, was in the most run-parched environment that we've seen in baseball since the dead ball era. I think he had like a 1.38 ERA or something along those lines in Dodger Stadium during his career, compared to like 3.10 everywhere else, or something like that's the order of magnitude we're talking here. Jaws sees him as not a great choice for the Hall of Fame just because of that short career length. And people like Dan Shaughnessy misunderstand that. I'm not saying that he doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame. One of the challenges of this book, and one that I really ended up embracing, I think, to a great degree, was, you know, the subtitle of it is Who's in the Hall of Fame, Who Should Be In It, Who Should Pack Their Plaques? Well, you know, I joke about dragging these plaques down to the basement, but in the end, you know, I found a lot to like about even the guys that are, like, some of the worst Hall of Famers.
Abbott Marinville?
What's that?
Rabbit Maridville? Ray Shock?
I mean, you know, they're like, all of these guys brought something to baseball history, and you know, to me, it's more important to understand what it is. You know, Rick Farrell, for example. I mean, whose brother has a better Hall of Fame case than him, a great hitting pitcher. He was a lousy hitter. The joke was always that the hearing aids were turned up or weren't turned up that day when they voted, Farrell! Yeah, Farrell! And they thought they were voting on the other brother. You know, there are things like that. But I'm not really comfortable with where Vlad Guerrero ranks. He's about 8 points short on Jaws. I mean, I left to my own devices, I would have assumed that he was certainly at least an average Hall of Famer. He's kind of below average for a Hall of Famer. So, whatever. He's going to get in, and I'm happy for that because I love watching Vlad play. But I'm not going to point to that as the best success of Jaws. But, the point for me is to take the system where it goes, you know, be guided by the numbers, but not be a slave to them.
Questions? Someone back there? Or, yeah, I mean, you, whoever's raising their hand, I guess you can give it to them.
Jay, I was wondering how much you consider fame as a part of the Hall of Fame. For example, the thing that comes to mind for me is like David Ortiz versus Edgar Martinez. I think many would argue statistically that Martinez would have the better case, but David Ortiz obviously has the fame and the narrative as a part of baseball history. How much do you consider that when looking at the Hall of Fame?
I mean, you have to consider it as, you know, in terms of understanding who's in there. We're packed to the fucking rafters with guys who are famous. To me, the point of Jaws was always to make sure we recognize quality, you know, not necessarily just celebrating fame. As to Ortiz, I have a chapter on him in the book. He's well short of the mark in Jaws because he spent 87% of his career as a DH, whereas Edgar spent 72% of his career as a DH and played a credible third base, whereas Ortiz's first base was pretty half-assed. So there's a big difference in value there. I don't doubt that David Ortiz is going to the Hall of Fame. The postseason stuff, the historical stuff, I think probably overwhelms whatever the metrics say. And I understand that. But I don't think that there are a lot of guys that we have seen in the last 25 years that really have that same sort of fame oomph that are going to get them into the Hall of Fame the way it is going to be for him.
Anyone else? Questions? One right here. Sorry, I'm sorry if I'm like missing people. It's the light. It's
yeah. Hi. So I have one for Jay and one for Anthony, if I could. I'm over here on the left.
Oh, there you are. Hi. Okay, sorry. I pointed at you and then I forgot where I was.
Yeah. So I guess when it comes to the Hall of Fame ballot, I'm just wondering what is precluding the binary ballot where it's just however many guys are on the ballot and it's just a yes
what's,
or no.
What's precluding it is the fact that that's far too radical for the Hall of Fame to consider. I was on a ballot study committee a couple of years ago. It was chaired by Susan Slusser, the outgoing president of the BBWAA, and it had there were eight of us on the committee, and we ranged in, you know, like completely across the spectrum. It was a committee designed to produce, you know, a fairly modest consensus at best. And while there were some of us who would have loved to have proposed the binary ballot idea, I'm over here at the far left, the radical, there were some people who thought that, you know, nothing needed to change with the process. Ultimately, the idea of proposing the expansion of the ballot from 10 slots, which it's been since 1936 when the whole process started originally, and the major leagues were just 16 teams, to 15, because we now have 30 teams, seemed far too radical for even this panel to consider, so we ended up with 12. There was no way in hell we were going to get a binary ballot. As it was, even 12 was too radical for them, too spicy. and they tabled that one. They didn't outright reject it, to their credit, but they tabled it, and you know, we're in limbo on that.
Okay. We're gonna come back over here, and we're gonna, I'm bad at cutting people off, but we are gonna have to do that at some point. But there's someone here who's both got a question and also a friend endorsing his question. We're gonna get him the mic.
I'm coming.
Hi. So I apologize for A, asking this in New York, and B, asking it with my accent. But talking about the focus on postseason stats as being so important when it comes to Hall of Fame, do we think that that's the reason why Alan Trammell is unlikely to ever get in? Whereas someone with I believe two wins above replacement more than him is a stone lock for the first ballot, which is Derek Jeter. And yeah. part two of that is, do we also think that postseason stats matter, which is why Joe Carter is probably the most overrated player of all time?
You know, to get to the first part, certainly postseason, I think, has an outsized importance. And I think it's an injustice that Alan Trammell spent 15 years on the ballot and only in his final year got the level of support, like half the level of support that he needs to get into the Hall of Fame. I have him in the top 12 of my system. I forget exactly where. He's somewhere in there. I think he's just ahead of Derek Jeter. It's like 10 Trammell, 11 Bill Dahl, and 12 Jeter, or like some combination of those three. But yeah, the postseason stuff is going to help Jeter. Jeter would be higher if it weren't for the fact that his like the metrics just hate his defense, and rightfully so. You know, we're talking about a guy who's what in the top 10 all time in career hits and times on base. You know, and was you know really an exemplary player and playing on the biggest stage in New York. But has, you know, advantages conferred by that, whereas Trammell was on a team that, you know, played in a different playoff structure, only got to the postseason twice. His teammate Jack Morris shit the bed once, which prevented them from advancing even when they were by far the better team in the 1987 ALCS. You know, and that's been part of it. Now, as to the Joe Carter thing, I'm not really sure where that fits in because Carter never really got much of a sniff on the Hall of Fame ballot, nor should he have. He was a guy who hit a lot of home runs and did very little else. So, you know, he had a big moment in the postseason, but unlike, say, Bill Mazeroski, who had a very similar big moment, the walk-off home run in the 1960 World Series, you know, Mazeroski was renowned for his defensive excellence, and that combination of those two factors propelled him into the Hall of Fame. Carter really didn't have that second credential that got him anywhere, and nor should he have. You know, he gets to live with that home run, and that's a pretty special thing. And you know, I don't want to take anything away from that because that's got to be pretty cool.
All right, let's do one more question. Who's going to be our last question? Right next to you, that guy behind you. Sorry. Ah, okay, I'm bad.
Thank you. This question is primarily for Jay, but if anyone else wants to contribute, I'd be happy to hear it. It seems as if we're at the point where even relatively casual baseball fans understand the value of non-traditional triple crown stats like walks and stolen base percentage and run prevention as opposed to one loss record, but is there ever going to be a similar change to properly appreciate the careers of players who either play catcher or third base or other positions which have been kind of historically underrepresented in part because players who are good hitters rarely play their whole careers at those positions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we've got a richer set of data now with regards to catchers, but it's going to take a long time to catch up as far as the Hall of Fame voting. I mean, even if you use what Baseball Prospectus called the retroframing methodology, which is going back to 1988 when we have pitch-by-pitch data, and even from that, without knowing location, we can sort of infer statistically which catchers were the best at getting called strikes in those situations, and it turns out Mike Piazza was especially good at that, and like, you know, it restores a lot of understanding to what teams saw, the team saw the value of him behind the plate. As I write about in the book, well, actually, to finish the thought on catchers first, I mean, there are only a small handful of catchers that we can bring framing into the discussion in a Hall of Fame context. You know, we're going to have that for Yadier Molina, we'll have that for Buster Posey, but we really don't have a whole lot of that for even Pudge Rodriguez, who just went in. As for the third baseman, I write about that at length in the book, in a chapter on Ron Santo, and they've always been kind of treated as sort of like neither fish nor fowl, a position that's got offense and defensive responsibilities that are both pretty impactful. And I think we're seeing a wave of third basemen here especially Adrian Beltre, a guy who's like a master on both sides of the ball, is going to be recognized. And I hope that Scott Rowland will too. He's hitting the ballot this year. And if there's one essay I could have put in the book that I actually didn't lift a finger to write yet, it would have been Scott Rowland, because I think he needs the push.
I'm curious, I'm going to sneak in a question before we get off the stage, because you brought up Adrian Beltre, and when did he go from being like a funny, happy-go-lucky, good player to like a sure thing Hall of Famer? I feel like there are not a lot of guys who make that transition in their career.
Beltre had a really interesting career. I mean, like with the Dodgers and the Mariners, he was an excellent defender who was always seen as a disappointment because he couldn't live up to that 48 home run 2004 season just before he hit free agency. You know, he had some injuries, and some of them more notorious injuries. It really wasn't until he started playing in hitter-friendly ballparks, 2010 with the Red Sox, and then the rest ever since then with the Rangers, that he'd start playing these favorable offensive contexts. And I think that helped him grow as a hitter. And I think, you know, there's an old adage that guys who win gold gloves, they win them as much because they're hitting as because of their defense. And for him, I think once he started contributing to a great degree on offense, people started to notice all the facets of his game more. And especially in Texas, becoming sort of this like elder statesman on teams that were competitive, that further enhanced his reputation. And suddenly he's become like, I don't know, I would say he's maybe like the most beloved player in the game this side of Bartolo Colon, at least on social media. It's really interesting to see. I mean, you know, there are people who didn't realize he was sneaking up on 3,000 hits. And if you told them that Adrian Beltre was about to become a lock for the first ballot of the Hall of Fame, they would have said, get the hell out of here. And now it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. You've got a guy with 3,000 hits, 450 home runs. There are like 12 of those guys in baseball history. 12, period.
All right, we are going to have to get off the stage that way. Jeff Sullivan and Ben Lindbergh can come up here. But Jay had a good tweet, so we should all clap for that.
Thank you
so much.
I always love taking the questions on these.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you,
Lindsay. Thank you, guys, for coming out.